Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Robert O'Hearn, and we're across from Peter Phelps, who has come in to talk about the Bulldog track, which is not a memoir, it's not a history, it's a... What is it?
Well, it's a hybrid of biography and history and a very personal account of my grandfather's trek through New Guinea and my father at living in Sydney and being the man of the house to three sisters and his mother over a six-month period in 1942.
So, as booksellers, Rob and I like to have simplicity. Where would we put it? Where would you like us to put it on our shelves in a bookshop? In the front window.
In the front window, on the front desk, in every single genre, facing the customer.
Okay.
No spine, just from the whole cover.
Because we're dealing with 1942, but your grandfather wasn't a soldier, he was a miner, is that the deal?
He was a gold miner and a carpenter on the gold fields of in a town called Bololo. And in Papua New Guinea in 1942. The six-month period of the story, the war had been going for 2 years. It was in the Depression, so he wasn't getting any work in Sydney as a carpenter. He was too old to enlist at 45, and he had a gammy leg from a construction site accident, so he couldn't enlist. So he was offered a job with a Canadian company, parent company of gold mining company, and he was employed by the Bololo Gold Dredging Company. It was a three-year tenure in the gold fields. And he'd been never outside of the western suburbs of Sydney, so it was quite an adventure for him. He was potentially going to get three times as much a wage per month than he would have got in Sydney, because it was very speculative, the work for a carpenter in Sydney at the time. And my father was very sort of angry at the prospect of his father leaving him, and of course his dream was to play for the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs.
How old was he?
He was 13 at the time. And then in March of 1942, the Japanese, after previously, a month previously, they bombed Pearl Harbor and had taken Singapore, and had invaded two northern coastal towns in Papua New Guinea of Leh and Salamaua. And they then, in March the 4th, 1942, they bombed his gold mining town. And he was too old to enlist then as well. So he and 200 other miners set out on a trek that the natives had advised them to take, which was a native trade route that became known as the Bulldog Track, the title of the book. And they were the first white fellas to set trek on this trail that led them to an old gold mining town called Bulldog, thus the name. And that became from the mountains down to the floodplains and the rivers, which they built handmade rafts, and they ventured into Kuka territory, who were the cannibal tribes at the time. It was an Australian territory, so the cannibalism was a banned. And it did quieten out, but they did run into these tribes. And because when they confronted them, they had their women and children with them this particular time. And when the women were with them, they didn't hunt for heads.
Yeah.
So they end up surviving that and several other adventures that's all in documented in the book.
I mean, you're one of Australia's most successful and well-known actors. You've been on our screens for I would just say years.
years.
For a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not a historian. How did you tackle this story? Was it something that the family talked about?
No, it was very, very minimally over the years, and I didn't know. I thought for so many years that he was a soldier and he went missing for a period of 6 months, lost in the jungle trying to evade the Japanese. But I had fragments of information from my auntie, who was sort of more or less the family historian, and my father would tell me snippets, but he didn't give too much away. I pieced it together through what was documented, and that was mainly, well, pretty much exclusively military, because, you know, the Kokoda campaign happened 4 months after this this story of my grandfather. So everything that I got in my research was leading up to, was military-based, because these civilian gold miners didn't keep any document. The only document I had, which I based a lot of the chapters on, is in the book, was he kept a diary that he wrote with his carpenter's pencil on his helmet, his pith helmet. I got, that was my blueprint for the story.
The helmet,
chronologically. I've got the helmet.
You got the helmet.
Yeah.
Cool.
I had it most often, when I was writing the book, so that it was something tangible right next to me that I could refer to and say, where were you now, Pop? What were you up to? And I talked to that and a map that he had, he made a mud map as he went on baking paper with indelible ink.
Yeah.
So, I think you had that kind of, if you lost one, he'd have reference to the other. And there was very brief things, like he'd say like ate native food, hunted tree kangaroo, missionaries arrived. And from those little tiny snippets written on his helmet, I would say, okay. And I know that for a fact, that you were there on that date because you've got it on your helmet. So I embellished the story around that, knowing that that fact actually happened.
Yeah.
And, use the actor and the poet within me, I suppose, to write the story around the fact.
It is an extraordinary story. And this is one of the things that war does. It forces ordinary people into these crazy circumstances, and all these guys, I mean, just forced into the bush.
Yeah. And such an Australian story too, because they just got on with it, you know. Okay, how do we get down this river? I'm a carpenter, there's an American with him on his particular trip, and he said, any American kid that grew up near a river or a water source wanted to be Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer, so let's build a raft. So they did. They were very resourceful, and you know, the Japanese bombed their town, and after that, they just marched out, and they wanted to get. They were lined up to get flown out of Wau, which was about 20 miles up the track, up in the highlands, and then the Japanese bombed them as well, decimating all the planes. There's the only way out of there was by air or foot.
Mm.
So they got out of there by foot, being the Aussies that they are, and they couldn't enlist. Most of the miners enlisted to fight in a lot of the campaigns, including Kokoda, mostly the Kokoda campaign, which happened 4 months later. And it was just a great Australian story of, you know, like, let's go, let's just walk home, you know, bugger the Japs. Because they thought the Japs might, they didn't let you surrender. They'd either intern you or kill you, and which they did, wholesale.
And so your father is here, and your grandmother is obviously here in Sydney.
Yeah.
They have no idea where he is.
They have no idea. From the bombing, there was no communication to Australia or to anywhere. So there was a very scant military force there of New Guinea Volunteer Rifles, who weren't really fully enlisted. They were kind of like a security force. They became the Kanga Force, which were instrumental in a lot of the campaign. But by the time my grandfather had left the town of Bulolo, this Australian force scorched earth the whole town, because they didn't want the Japanese who were invading, coming from the north. They didn't want them to have anything. They'd already, shot up all the planes and the communication, the powerhouse. And so there was nothing left of the town once my grandfather left it. And the only way out was by foot and by this mystery track.
Mm.
And they went into villages that even the native, they virtually had a native carrier to each white man, and the villages that they were going heading south, they were as foreign to the native carriers as they were to the white gold miners.
Mm.
So they were always going into foreign territory. They didn't know if it was going to be the cannibal tribe or the friendly tribe, and the natives were armed with bows and arrows, and spears and hunting knives. And you can just imagine this foreign tribe that didn't even speak the same tongue with, you know, 15 to 20 white fellas alongside them. It would have been like something, because some of them hadn't even seen a white man.
Mm.
Seeing them coming into their village, it makes for quite a story.
You say in the book that the stories that you heard as a child were like Tarzan.
Well, yeah, that because I didn't know anything else. When my grandfather would say something, he'd used to teach us snippets of pidgin English, and I'd imagine me being there with him and being boy to his Tarzan, you know, and because it was only the romance side of it that you hear. You don't hear of, you know, death on the trail, that they, you know, they buried some of their fellows along the way. And I've only heard the adventure bits, and just imagine it, because we did see Tarzan on TV, and, yeah, you know, that's your sense of the jungle.
And at what point did you feel that was worth pursuing as a book? When did that kind of story become this truth?
I pursued it because it was actually my mother who said, you know, your father's very sick, and when we all sort of leave the planet, this story will be lost. So I decided to, you know, tell the story, and let it be known, because it's such a great story of adventure and, you know, a time that will never be again in Australia, you know. My family grew up in, my mother and father grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, which is, it's a whole other world now.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to document that as a piece of history as well.
And your father passed when you were halfway through writing the book, which must have been a blow. Did that open the floodgates for even more information?
Absolutely. You know, as well as having a deadline that I had to reach, I had my father's blessing that he said, you'll be right with what you got, because he knew I could string some words together and tell the family story. So it was, he was helping me out with the times, because as he got more and more sick, his long-term memory was fantastic. And as we always hear, that the short-term memory wasn't so good, you know. So I was getting really detailed observations of 1942 Sydney, and, you know, playing street cricket and hunting rabbits, and you know, it was just fascinating. And because it's so personal, that I wanted to, you know, do it as a kind of a gift to my grandfather and my father.
Oh, it's a wonderful tribute to the legacy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a real pay-in to them at the times that they lived, and, you know, I just only have fond memories of both of them. Of arguments over, because my father moved from the western suburbs to the northern beaches in Sydney, and there was a lot of arguments about him also going from a Labor to a Liberal voter. intense ones, because my grandfather was Jack Lang Labor, and that's one of my fondest memories of, like, okay, who am I going to go for?
So you talked about your father being resentful that your grandfather would leave for that long. When he disappears, was that resentment turned into? Is that even greater, or is that now turned into hope, or what is it?
No, the resentment and the sense of abandonment, it dissipated until when he started seeing the newsreels of what was happening in there, and his father was in there somewhere. That was only longing and you know, hopefully not grief, but because the army had told them, they'd visited him once and said that he is missing and presumed dead, because the Japanese were bombing the crap out of the place. Mm. And even along the trail that they thought they might be on. And there's no communication. They had no radio, so no one knew where they were. They just presumed that these elderly miners, as they called them, who couldn't enlist because they were too old and too sick, made a trek that was far harder and longer and steeper and wetter and muddier than the Kokoda track was. So they were going through the stages of grief for quite a few months.
Did you go back to New Guinea, or have you spent time in New Guinea?
I started school in New Guinea.
Right.
Yeah, in Port Moresby. The family has always had an attraction and a connection to their my grandfather. When he, no spoiler alert, but he did make it out. because obviously there's photos of the trek there. Which is amazing in itself that they had photo and film stock that survived. That's in the book. Let me get back onto what I
I was talking about. Your time in New Guinea yourself.
Yeah. Experiences. My grandfather went back several other times. He visited the you'll call them houseboys. He was more of an assistant because he helped with his carpentry as well as being a labourer in the gold mines. He went to the village there several times and went back to Port Moresby to work again. And my father was a refrigeration and air conditioning engineer, and he was with a company that was commissioned to the Australian Army. So he used to go to the barracks in Port Moresby and fly out to different places as a refrigeration air conditioning guy. And I started school there in 1967. We were there for a couple of years, and I used to fly to some of these places where they didn't see snowy-haired boys very much. So I was kind of like a bit of a presence.
Yeah.
And I used to get dressed up in, Sing Sing outfits and go to Sing Sings. And they didn't do it to any other Westerners except a snowy-haired Aussie boy.
Yeah.
So I remember that sort of thing. So there's always been something about New Guinea, always in the family.
And this sort of, when you start doing this kind of research can become kind of addictive.
Have you
caught the bug?
It is attractive. And I kind of like diving into, the State Library here, the Mitchell Library, and getting books out of special collection and these little gems of things that you can work on and expand. And as I said before, it was only really the military stuff that I got, but they mentioned that there was these miners that were headed out on a trek, and then you see then you find out the fact that there was a gag order on all the journalists that were there, journalists such as Osmar White and George Johnston. They couldn't say to anything in the press about these miners, 200 miners that were on the way. So that's why there wasn't anything documented, and it was quite a hard. But as you said, it's fun. And I know the next book that I do, I just want to get right into the research because you just get these little dollops of knowledge that are just going to help you along the way. Then you sort of make it lyrical what you've got.
Well, when you put the book out into the hands of readers, there'll be people who come out and say, related to one of the 200.
Yeah,
I can tell you.
The ones that I tried to find, they all come out after the book's published. It's like, yeah, I can just see it. Yeah. I did have one son of someone that trekked with my pop. And he's a cameraman. He was a cameraman at Channel 7. So, and I've done a lot of shows at Channel 7, so I probably worked with him. And he's the only one that I've been on social media with that had, and he wasn't told anything by his father about this trek. And I think that was across the board. They're just this, like, what did you do in the war, Grandpa? Ah, nothing much, you know. There was all that. And that happens in so many families.
Yeah, the stories often come out.
And then I've plopped a few reasons why he might have been silent because, and I don't say what it was. I leave it to the reader to ponder why he went to New Guinea, leaving his family for 3 years. It wasn't just to get money, I don't think. He was involved in an accident where a girl was killed and he was driving his truck. And only a few months later he went to New Guinea. So, there's all these possibilities of why, And I just leave that up to the reader to sort of think about.
This is the first time I've ever heard of it. Was there anything anywhere, like in the press? Like, these guys return home, there's nothing?
The only one I got was a letter that my grandfather sent to the Sydney Morning Herald in a few months after he got back from this adventure. Because there was another report a few weeks previous to his letter that mentioned that they're building the Bulldog Road, which was going to be a supply route for the Kokoda campaign. And it only mentioned very briefly about these miners that actually forged the trail. So my grandfather sent a letter saying, I'd just like to mention that there was about 200 of us that went over this trail to, you know, some of them died. And it was our efforts that I think, you know, the army decided to build one of the greatest military engineering works ever. And that's according to General Thomas Blamey. And he said, like, he put his hand up to say that we had something to do with that.
Yeah. Well, the civilians don't often get a mention, do they?
Well, no. No, because that's not where the drama is, but it certainly was the drama with my grandfather.
Peter, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the Bulldog Track with us. It's an extraordinary story. Rob and I had never heard of it before. And
yeah,
I mean, it's amazing. And it's great that it's now out there. And I think, as Rob said, it's probably going to, you know, there's probably lots of families out there who would be dying to know as much as you've found and put together in this book. It's a real help for them.
Yeah, well, hopefully everyone reads it before I turn it into a miniseries, which is my goal.
Really? Oh, marvellous.
And playing my grandfather.
I'd like to say that it's a great book about fathers and fathers
and
sons.
Yes.
And coming up to Father's Day, it's just perfect.
Yes. You're thinking like a publisher.
Good work, Rob. Thinking about Father's Day, this is a perfect book for Father's
That's
Day.
It.
Well, nice work, Rob.
That's it. That's why we're getting it out there. It's I think well, you know, I want everyone to read it, but I think it's just a great in such a digital age. This is a completely analog moment, you know. There was no communications of any kind right through this story, and it was only a very, very primal time for my grandfather. And it was like, you know, the only technical things they had were like knives, and you know, you know. So I think that'll appeal to people, especially a demographic of an older Australian who remembers that time. You know, and of rations and, you know, everything done by hand. And, it's a kind of historical piece in that way.
I can't believe you didn't get my message. I wrote it on pith helmet.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Peter, for coming in.
Cheers, thanks.
And you can get hold of Bulldog Track at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.